listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont, on this rainy Labor Day. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with Priscilla Long. She is a Seattle-based writer of poetry, essays, creative nonfiction, fiction, science, and history. She has an MFA from the University of Washington, and she teaches writing. Her book about writing is The Writer's Portable Mentor, A Guide to Art, Craft, and the Writing Life, and that is published by Wallingford Press. Her abecedarium, My Brain on My Mind, appeared in the winter 2010 issue of The American Scholar. Genome Tome, which also appeared in The American Scholar, received a National Magazine Award for Best Feature Writing. She is author of Where the Sun Never Shines, A History of America's Bloody Coal Industry. Her essays, short stories, and poems have appeared in The Southern Review, The Gettysburg Review, Fourth Genre, Southern Poetry Review, Raven Chronicles, North Dakota Quarterly, The American Scholar, Ontario Review, The Seattle Review, Chattahoochee Review, Passages, North, Painted Bride Quarterly, Under the Sun, Michigan Quarterly Review, The Cincinnati Review, and other venues. She serves as senior editor of HistoryLink.org, the online encyclopedia of Washington state history. She was a Jack Straw writer for 2009. Her awards also include the Richard Hugo House Founders Award and awards from the Seattle Arts Commission and the Los Angeles Arts Commission. I spoke to Priscilla Long in August. Her book, The Writer's Portable Mentor, covers a lot. It covers larger writing issues such as observation and writing into structure and voice. And it also covers really more concrete writing concerns like sentences and punctuation. So when I spoke to her, I asked her to start by talking about how she decided what to include in the book.
I worked on the book for 15 years as I was teaching all of these craft things, and I teach mostly very advanced writers, although this book works great for beginners and at writers at all levels. And so as the years went on, the book started with teaching sheets, and we were working on many, many craft issues from the compound sentence and how the virtuoso writers use it and hardly anyone else does to punctuation issues and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Was it difficult to figure out what you would not include in the book? I'm curious if there was anything that had to go.
Not really. I mean, this book it kind of does sum up everything I knew as of last July. So, I think that's the strength of it. It's a very it's not a narrow book. It is a big book. I mean, it's not that long. It's 360 pages, but
right.
It really does hold everything that I've learned. And of course, as a writing teacher, no one learns more than the teacher.
Yeah.
So this has been my craft development over the years, as well as my mentees and the writers that I work with. Everything from using color in prose to the phrasal adjective. It's not really a grammar book or anything like that. It is a book on how to raise your writing to the virtuoso level, I think, as well as issues of the writing life and so on.
Okay, yeah, that's great. And we'll get into talking a little bit more in detail about some of those things. The book is full of writing exercises, and actually, in this show, I suggest writing prompts each week as part of the show.
Oh,
And the feedback I've gotten has indicated that, you know, some people love writing exercises, and then they're not for everyone. I mean, some people really don't want to work that way. I'm wondering if you've noticed in your teaching any trends about which kinds of exercises work best, or what kind of people most enjoy working with them.
Well, all the writers I work with do the exercises, and the most important person who does the exercises is me. Mm-hmm. Because, of course, I am a writer, and the exercises here are really a working writer's exercises. I mean, a beginner can use them, and that's, you know, of course, but they are exercises because I've developed them over many years of teaching and writing. And when I teach, I do all the assignments myself and give them to the class. So, and I'm working with adult writers, mm-hmm. not that you would do that with an eighth grade class or even a freshman composition class, but I'm working with professional adult writers, and so that's what I do. And so, therefore, the exercises are tested over and over, and mm-hmm. I've eliminated ones that didn't work as well. But every writer has, in this book, we find every writer has ones they totally love and then ones they don't get and they struggle with.
So it's just the individual.
The individual exercises. And it just varies. I mean, there's no one exercise everyone just can't stand.
Right.
but over the years, we've learned how to make each exercise as effective as it can be.
I noticed that a lot, and I've noticed this through the years, a lot of exercises encourage writing without stopping, without raising your pen, it sometimes says. I don't know if you say that in here, but just write without stopping, write without stopping. Mm-hmm. Why is that so effective, or why is that recommended?
I think that in terms of basic productivity, if you do discovery writing and writing without stopping, that gets a lot more done than sitting in front of a blank page or a blank screen. Mm-hmm. And so that's been proved over and over. Now there are ways of focusing writing without stopping. And that's important. So it can be just, you know, kind of the, I think it's Julia Cameron that talks about the, what does she call that? The three pages, the morning pages.
Right.
And that's good. That's good. That's totally fine. But there are many, many ways of focusing discovery writing or free writing. As Peter Albo, who's another, who's a really very erudite teacher of writing, calls it. For example, you can focus and write a whole essay that way. And then, of course, you type it, then you compose, then you work it. But it's much faster. It really is a strategy toward productivity. At least that's what I've found.
Mm-hmm. I enjoyed reading about your habit of collecting or gathering words. Can you talk a little bit about what this means and how you came to do it?
I noticed that I've seen writers write for years and years and years, and their writing does not give them back what it should for all that work. Mm-hmm. And one of the clear reasons is that they're rather passive about collecting language and immersing themselves in language. So, and if you read the really virtuoso writers, I mean, there are many of them, but if you read them, you see that they have a tremendous richness of language. And it's not about being flowery, or it's not about using big words or anything like that. But a lot of it is about knowing the names of things,
mm-hmm.
And things like that. I think that what writers like that do in their each one's different way of doing it is to actually actively collect language. And you have accounts like Annie Proulx or Mary Oliver goes out with a notebook, and she is collecting language.
Mm-hmm.
She is collecting the names of the bugs.
Right.
And Annie Proulx is in antique shops collecting old saddles and things, and she's writing down all their names. Or Cormac McCarthy. That is what they're doing. And so I came into this because I started a long time ago, really, but it was a very important emotional and turning point moment for me as a writer. I started writing about my childhood, not writing about my childhood really, but just collecting words that had to do with my childhood, which was, I grew up on a dairy farm on the eastern shore of Maryland, and these words were completely unique to my childhood. Mm. There were words like greenbrier, stanchion, and all the dairy farming terms.
Were they words that you recalled, or you had to go asking, like, what were the words that described these things I don't remember well?
No, I recalled the words before I even started writing. I just started making lists of words.
Okay.
And the and what was amazing, and I had put away my childhood. I lived in Boston at the time. I was a printer. None of my friends had come from this kind of background. And so I had just put away my childhood. And so it started coming back in these words. And I eventually filled a notebook with these words. And I realized the words themselves, without any additional anything, sentences or anything, actually held my childhood. And then I did write little stories about my childhood that were just purely exactly what happened. Mm-hmm. Without comma. And that was my first published, quote, fiction.
Okay.
It actually wasn't fiction at all. It was like every word of it was true. But then, of course, then I realized, whoa, of course, every childhood has a lexicon. The toys in the 1980s were different from the toys in the 1950s, were different from the toys in the 1970s, much less, the 1860s.
Right.
So every person has, and every person has a lexicon in terms of their trade, in terms of their clothing, and of course every place has a lexicon, the plants and the geographical formations and so on. And so that this type of immersion in language, I just started doing it more and more.
Mm-hmm.
And then now I've, of course, started teaching it. So we actually keep lexicon books, and these are books that these are blank books that we put words in, and then you can start to work with sound. If you are working with what I call conventional received diction, if you're working with just words that come to mind, and you kind of have a passive, you might not think it's passive, but if you just look up a word occasionally in a dictionary, and that's it, that's a kind of a passive approach to mm-hmm. language. You don't have very much to go on if you're making list sentences and working with sound, for example. You just simply don't have enough language to work with, because you don't have enough words echo against each other, or if you're describing, a room, and things like every room, every person's living room, the objects in the room they reflect the person who lives there. Now, if
sure.
two people or three people live there, it gets a little murky, but every person's objects say something about them they're characterizing. So nothing is neutral. Nothing is like a lump of flour in the dough. Nothing in literature is neutral. It's
right.
just there to be pretty. And usually nothing in a room is neutral. If you look at someone's room, or if you've ever had occasion to deal with a person's effects after their death, one is extremely struck by how significant these objects, which are kind of nothing once they're in the thrift shop or whatever, wherever they go, but to the person are just loaded with meaning.
Sure.
And
yeah.
so that practice, and it becomes a practice. It just simply gives the writer a much huger resource base
right.
out of which to write, and it's also fun.
And it must just provide the specificity that helps get closer to that meaning.
Yeah, and I mean completely.
Yeah.
And also, whenever I start a piece of any kind, I make a list, a word list for it. And I keep adding to that word list. This is separate from the actual space that I'm writing the piece on. Mm-hmm. I keep that word list, and I keep adding to it as I'm writing the piece. And the word list, this way the word list holds, more and more holds the piece. And they do tend to be concrete, specific words.
Right.
They tend to be words that you can perceive with one of the five or six or however many senses we have, rather than abstract words.
Yeah. Another part of the book that I thought offered wonderful suggestions was the observing the here and now section of the book, which sort of helps writers think about training ourselves to notice what's happening around us and training ourselves to record sensory observation, which I think gathering words does some of that too, but also just going out into the world.
Yeah, I mean, one thing you can do is, the exercise is to go with a notebook and sit someplace and actually record just what's there, not your opinions or observations or perceptions or all those things, simply what is in front of you. And now, how you can use this is you can go to a setting and you can write down the whole setting. You know, in other words, if you wanted to, if I wanted to write a short story that was set in Pioneer Square in Seattle, I would certainly go to Pioneer Square in Seattle and sit there and write down everything that's in front of me that I see. And then I wouldn't use it, I wouldn't just type it and use it, but I would have my setting, basically. And I've done that. I've gone to the coast of Massachusetts. I have a story that's set on the coast of Massachusetts
mm-hmm.
called Storm, and I lived in Boston for a long time, but so I knew the area, but I went to the coast and sat there and wrote about the granite and all that, and so that's one use. But the other use is that the more you do this as the practice, the more you see.
Right.
And the more you, and I think that we writers need to have insight, and we need to have an insight starts with sight. And it's not that we're necessarily born with this extra insight. I mean, we're not. No one would think so, I don't think. But we develop it with our practices, and this practice comes from the visual arts.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the visual art, a person learning to draw and a person who draws sits and simply draws what's there. And over and over. And one visual arts exercise is to go someplace, observe it, and then go back to someplace else and go back to the studio and paint what you've observed. And that's another way to do this here and now. You can also do it here and now. From memory, the here and now is not original with me. It's an old exercise, and it does come from the visual arts. But it's a very, very useful exercise.
Yeah, yeah. I wonder, can we talk a little bit about, I keep just changing subjects here, but there's so much to cover. You have a lot in this book. And I enjoyed the section on narrative voice. And one question that I wanted to ask you to comment on, because it seems like sometimes writing students get confused about this, the difference mm-hmm. between a character's voice and mm-hmm. and what people are referring to when they talk about an author's writing voice, which I think develops over time and has a different meaning entirely.
Mm-hmm. First, let's talk about the author's voice.
Okay.
Writers talk about developing their voice all the time,
yeah.
which I think is a little bit of an error in thinking because as you develop, now, I can look back at all my writing, and I can see that I, in fact, have a voice. Mm-hmm. I can see that. But that's not because I decided I wanted to develop my voice. It is because I am attracted to certain things, and I think that's how a writer develops his or her voice. You're attracted to certain kinds of sounds. You're attracted to certain kinds of subject matters, of course, but even more close to home, you're attracted to certain kinds of sentences, certain kinds of words, certain kinds of objects, and those attractions, and you work with extreme honesty, emotional honesty, whether you're writing fiction or nonfiction. So, and thereby it turns out, oh, I have a voice. This is really interesting. So you're not trying, because, and the reason I say this is because what you are doing, hopefully, is you are looking very closely at all kinds of different models of virtuoso writing. And that is really underlies a lot of the philosophy of this book and of Beethoven studied Handel very closely. And you can go through various creators in various genres, and they studied the predecessor creator. But then you also have a force against that, because you don't want to just be an imitator.
Right.
So, but you do want to develop this range of strategies. You don't want to just... I should say that, of course, we are all under the influence all the time. We are under the influence of television. We are under the influence of newspaper talk, television talk, internet talk. We're under the influence. So what we're doing here is putting ourselves under the influence of virtuoso writing, but not just one or two, because that would certainly give us an imitation, imitative style, which we don't want at all, but rather changing models all the time. So that's the author's voice.
Right.
Now, a character's voice, the practice is to actually, with your notebook that you carry around, copy down exactly what people say, and to realize that every character, meaning person, person, character, actually does have a voice. They have a certain way of expressing things. It's occupational, it's ethnic, it's class, it's age, the age of the person. If I say like she like, how does that go? She like, I'm not that age. She like, what age I'm talking about.
She like couldn't think of what to say.
Yeah, she like couldn't think. Or he's like, what do you mean?
right.
So that's voice. When you're writing a story, or when you're interviewing, if you're writing a nonfiction piece, and you interview someone, the thing to write down is, you'll remember the gist really well without you, and you can't write down the gist anyway. But you'll remember it when after the interview, you go to your private space and write down everything you remember. But what you write down are the specific expressions that they use, the house painter talks about exercising the windows.
Yep.
And different people have different ways of saying different things. And so writing down those as you're walking around, or you're, in a public place, or even, in your family or in your home, in your household, writing down specific expressions will... sometimes they actually give you dialogue, so that's nice.
Yeah.
Found dialogue, but this fits my character perfectly. Thank you.
Yeah.
But also it increases your ear. It develops your ear for voice, because in beginning writers you often have a story where everyone sounds exactly the same,
mm-hmm.
and that's what you want to learn. That's a craft skill. It's a very high craft skill to have each character have their own voice. And so it sort of starts with a sensitivity and awareness. It is a kind of observation exercise. It's another kind of observation exercise where you go around and you're actually writing down voice. You're eavesdropping, basically. And we can do that because we're writers.
Right.
So.
It seems like so much of it is practice and paying attention and writing it all down.
Yes.
I wonder if you can talk a little bit, you write in the book about what should happen when a new character appears in a story. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit about that, you know, what should happen.
Yes, it's as if you're watching a play on a stage or a film. A new character enters and they get a portrait. They get a visual. Mm-hmm. They have clothes on, or unless they're naked, they have clothes on. they have a certain coloration. They have, and so one thing we work on is coloration, actually, in color. they have, you know, a certain color, skin color, hair color, eye color, clothing color. Mm-hmm. They have a certain way of moving. They are dressed, so we have this. If a character enters and the character, and there's quite a bit of description. I mean, you don't have to make this very long, but if there's quite a bit of description, that tells you that the character is going to be very important.
Mm-hmm.
But you can have a doorman who only makes the briefest of appearances, and yet if you're actually going through a door and there's a doorman, you know he's tall or he's a very fat man with a black suit on, or just
dandruff on his shoulder or something.
Yes, you have a visual. So it can be, you know, one line or it can be a paragraph. And then you can thread that visual through, not the same words, but every time a person speaks, or almost every time a person speaks, they can have a visual. Now, there are different kinds of experimental writing where there's all dialogue and no visuals, but that's because the writer wanted to try that. But that's very different from forgetting the visuals because you aren't used to doing visuals. So this is a practice, too, of doing what I call portrait work. Mm-hmm. Person comes on stage, give them a visual. And it typically, it's clothing, it's gesture, it's coloration, those three things, and body type. The first, when someone's coming down the street towards you, they have a body type, that's the first thing you're going to notice. Mm-hmm. And the book gives examples of this, but it's another practice that you can get really good at, and it's fun too.
And if it's not going to be a very important character, are you suggesting just to maybe include one of these things? You don't have to include all of these things about a character that's just making a quick appearance. Is that true? Or,
well, I mean, yeah, you do it. You do it in a very brief. You can do it in a very brief way. But often the brief thing has a little clothing, the huge man in the white shirt, mm-hmm. tapping on the shoulder. I mean, that's body type, and I just made that up, you know, off the top of my head.
Sure.
But another thing is that once you start becoming aware of any of these things, so once you start becoming aware of using visuals and portraits, when you're in your reading, you'll see it all the time.
Mm-hmm.
All the time. And you'll start thinking, oh, here's Mary McCarthy, I think it is, and she has just passed a shop in the airport, and there's this saleswoman, and she just gives her this visual. I mean, you can see her.
Yeah.
Just as you can see a real saleswoman, you can see her. And so that's what it is. And it can be quite brief, but if you keep those things in mind, the body type, the clothing, the gesture, then, you know, that's helpful.
Yeah. Okay, great. The next thing I was hoping we could talk about is if you could describe the act of writing into structure. I found this very interesting. You suggest studying structure in the works of other writers and in your own work, writing into structure. So what did you mean by that?
There are different ways of doing that, the chapter on structure has models of structure. Mm-hmm. And one, for example, is a not original structure. It's a 9-paragraph essay on hummingbirds by Diane Ackerman. It's a great essay called Mute Dancers. And it appeared in the New York Times magazine, I think. And so, so when you get an assignment like that, you get a word count. Typically it's a word count. But I like to think of it as a 9-paragraph structure and think of each paragraph as a mason jar you're going to fill with something. And this is a different way of approaching. So let's say you're going to write a piece on something. And if you're using Diane Ackerman's great piece on the hummingbird, you are not going to write a piece on a bird using that structure. But you're going to write a piece on your grandfather.
Okay.
And so it's something totally different because you're looking at the structure really closely and you're eventually going to pull away. None of these exercises are meant to digress from writing finished, polished, published, eventually published pieces. And that's really, really important. So there's certain strategies. So we're looking at models very closely, but then we're doing it in such a way that we can pull away from them and have our own piece that might have a little hints, but isn't imitative. So then you look at what each paragraph is about, and then you basically make your paragraph about that. And when I do a thing like that, and this is not really an original structure. It's a standard structure, but she does it brilliantly. Many structures, deep structures, aren't particularly original. Some are. And it's a different way of approaching writing. The other way, the more common way, is to say, oh, okay, I'm going to write a piece on my grandfather, and so then I start floundering into the piece, and I flounder for X number of hours, days, or weeks, or months, or years. And how do I structure this? How do I structure this? How do I structure this? And I hear that over and over among writers. And so the other approach is actually to look at structure and say, okay, I think this, and to give it some thought. I think this structure would work with this piece. So once I have set that up, I say, all right, I'm going to write this piece on this, whatever it is, with using 9 paragraphs now. And when I do that, I actually am pretty strict about the 9 paragraphs, even if one paragraph turns out to be a page long. Eventually, I will break them up.
Yeah.
And eventually, the piece takes over. But I keep to that structure until I basically have a draft. It's a tremendous learning device, but it's also, it helps you become a much more productive writer.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think I went to a writing conference, a session in a conference once, which was on how to be productive as a writer, and there were 4 panelists, and they were all these incredibly productive writers, and they had not cheated, and they had not talked to each other before the panel, and they all said the same thing. I mean, it was quite striking. One, write every day, and each of them had kind of a word count, which was sort of around 1,000 words. Two, write into a structure. I mean, that was interesting. And so we can do that, and so part of it is to, and it helps to start with short pieces. And if you're writing a novel, you don't want to take the English Patient and write a novel on that structure, for example. No.
Right.
Everything published is in a structure. So
right.
You can start making a collection of structures. And so that you're not just deciding, I'm going to just use this 9-paragraph structure. That's one very useful structure, but there are collages. There's this form I love that I discovered, the ABCDarium, which is, A, B, C, D, E, F, G. And there's a 2-strand structure, A, B, A, B, A, B. And there are many different structures. So you can start collecting. And the interesting thing is that once you take this approach and you give some thought as to what content goes into what structure. So some content suggests its own structure. It's kind of organic rather than being mechanical. So, for example, I wrote a piece called Genome Tome that was published in the American Scholar. Mm-hmm. And Genome Tome, we have...
That won an award. What was the award that won?
Yeah, it won a National Magazine Award. That was great. Genome Tome, which is about our genome and the Human Genome Project. So we have 23 pairs of chromosomes. Mm-hmm. Okay, and so this Genome Tome has 23 chapters. And so there are... and then I wrote a piece called My Brain on My Mind, which is an ABCDarian. Mm-hmm. A, alphabet, B, brain, C, consciousness, D, what was D? Dementia or something. Anyway, so and so those forms are fun because then you're not just floundering about, oh, I'm going to write about the brain. I picked that form for the brain because neuroscience is so huge and it is, expanding every minute. There are hundreds of books. It's a field that's just exploding right now. And so how could I contain this thing?
Yeah, yeah.
How could I write this without writing forever?
Right.
5,000-page, essay. And so that form was very helpful.
Some of my friends who are excellent writers, just beautiful mm-hmm. writers,
mm-hmm.
still have a really hard time with punctuation, something they never got a handle on when they were younger. And I'm wondering mm-hmm. if you think it's harder to learn this sort of thing as an adult. Is it like learning French, where you're better off studying it, before you're 16? Is it really that much harder for adults to learn the rules of punctuation?
I have to say that I have learned everything as an adult. I had a terrible elementary school. It was one of the worst in the nation.
That's interesting.
And I did not learn to diagram sentences. And a lot of writers don't necessarily do this, and it's an interesting idea that to consider, which is to take a session each week, say, and to do a craft practice. And what that means is not just, and this is, applies to punctuation or any number of other things, to take something that you aren't good at or don't ever do.
Mm-hmm.
And because the virtuoso writers, the difference between them and the sometimes quite good but not the great writers, and that's always, a little subjective, but not really. That they know. Susan Sontag uses every kind of sentence, and I know this because I collect sentences, and I can open her collection of essays or any number of whatever, and I can get any kind of sentence out of one or two pages, no problem, because she uses them all. So to take a punctuation issue, not all punctuation, but the phrasal adjective, mm-hmm. or that issue of using in a this sentence, using commas within the using semicolons to separate items when you have a column comma within an item, that type of thing. Well, and if you hate semicolons, well then eliminate, and working with it.
Yeah.
Eliminating the comma within the item, just one thing at a time, and you have to have an adequate reference books mm-hmm. to do this. You're not just swimming, and the internet, falls down on this a little bit, unless you have the Chicago Manual style, unless you buy a subscription to it or something. But you have to have your reference books. And just to take a small thing, one time years ago, I was doing this, And because I did this because I didn't learn all of this in school. Mm-hmm. And so I decided, when I was in my 30s, I just became very frustrated. I just didn't know what to do. I was trying to be a writer. I don't think I really knew there were writing teachers.
Yeah.
And so I started hitting the books. And so I would take one thing at a time, and I remember taking the M-dash, what we call the dash, mm-hmm. and studying it. And then I incorporated it into my writing, and I learned how to use it, and I learned how not to use it. And so then, ever since, it's been part of what I can do. So to take an approach like that, and to either see a move done by another writer, or to go into a strategy that you've never done before. For example, if you look at, say, the novel Cold Mountain, that novel?
Yeah.
And other works, too. But if you look at, say, Cold Mountain, you'll find compound sentences, several, mm-hmm. on every page. Mm-hmm. And the compounds, and many writers never use the compound sentence at all, and or very seldom, or don't even know what it is. But all the virtuoso writers happen to use it all the time. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And when you first say, okay, what is this good for? I mean, this is not the third grade. We don't care. We're not going to get a test on this. But the compound sentence, which has, it's actually good for several things. But one thing it's good for is it has a tremendous amount of authority because it has two equal clauses, mm-hmm. that are, independent clauses. No clause is hanging off any other clause in this dippy, dependent way. And that's what gives it its power, and that's why in many sacred works there are many compound sentences. And so that's one thing it's good for. But so first you have to learn what it is and not make, and have your reference books so that you're not making errors, because if you're making errors, your ear is getting screwed up.
Yeah.
Because what you want is here, you want to develop an ear for what Hemingway does with it, for what, Charles Frazier and Cold Mountain does with it, what Susan Sontag does with it, what Mary Oliver does with it, and different writers do different things with it and get a different feel from it, but it has a certain effect, and the effect comes from its structure. So you can decide, okay, so I don't know this, so I want to incorporate this. Then you start putting it into your own writing, and what happens usually is it sounds awful, mm-hmm. because you haven't, it takes time to actually get into your own mode, and the first step is to get it correct, and which is available in any in your line of books that's on your desk. It's available.
Yeah.
And then the next step is not to say, well, this isn't part of my voice, because that's just not true. You just haven't learned how to use it in your voice, or to use it, and then it becomes part of your voice, basically. I guess that's what I'm saying. Well, that's just one small thing, but on and on. I mean, language is huge, and writing is huge. It's very rich.
There's always a reference, even if it's a little overwhelming.
Yeah, I wouldn't start in an overwhelming way. I would just take one thing.
Yep.
You don't take punctuation, you take the M dash.
Yeah.
You don't take, a lot of people have British and American punctuation mixed up.
Yeah.
There are reference works which will just state the difference very clearly. It's not rocket science, mm-hmm. actually, although it might seem like it. It isn't really.
It seems difficult. It's funny. I love that you've brought up the M-dash twice, and in the book you talk about how you're quite partial to it now, having learned how to use it. And it's funny because I love the M-dash, too. I use it all the time. Maybe too much.
Right. Yeah, usually editors take out a couple of my M-dashes. Oh, you don't like that M-dash. Oh, okay.
So this is a quote from the book. So this is you saying, mm-hmm. I am drawn to works that to me have significance, that offer insight. Alternatively, I shy away from works that seem slight, even if well written. And that quote comes from the part of the book that deals with connecting our writing with a wider world. And I wonder if we could talk a little bit about this.
Yeah. So part of the book is, I think this is the part you're in, is how to give our works more weight and more significance. Mm-hmm. And so there are several techniques that I've developed, and they're not all original with me. And one is to ask questions. And not only ask questions, ask, you know, write, again, set your timer and write for 10 minutes. What are all your questions about this subject? Or what are your character's questions?
Mm-hmm.
So ask questions and to realize that all questions can't be answered,
mm-hmm.
but yet should be asked, can be asked in the piece, or the character can ask the questions. So that's one.
Let me ask you this. So do you wait until you have a first draft and then you sit down and write yourself the question, what is this about? Or which is the most important thought that this provokes? Or what kinds of questions exactly?
So it depends on what you're writing. Well, no, first of all, I do all of this all at the same time that
before you've written
composing.
Anything.
I mean, I'll be making my list of words. I'll ask all the questions. Meanwhile, I'm composing paragraphs too.
Okay.
So I do it. I don't wait till the end. It's sort of a dialectic back and forth between mm-hmm. the notebook work and then once you're on the computer. So, but it depends on the piece. So, you know, if I'm working on the brain, my question would be, is IQ meaningful?
Mm-hmm.
Am I really as dumb as I feel sometimes? You know, I mean, any personal, from the most personal, what does it mean to feel stupid?
Yeah.
What does it mean to feel smart? How does the brain read? That question, you know, is answered in like 75 books, which I happen to be reading right now. So that was, or you could ask, then, and there's a great book I like a lot, Michael J. Gill, How to Think Like Leonardo da Vinci. One, and this is his exercise, set your timer, ask 100 questions that are important to you in your life.
Okay.
And then look at them. Just write without stopping, you know, just write without editing and censoring. Just simply write it out. And then choose the 10 that you think are the most important questions.
Mm-hmm.
And then type them up and then put them on your wall. Now, and then this is, the questions thing can go on and on because this, then you can say, well, if these are my important questions, and they can be anything from why was my mother so silent,
mm-hmm.
to personal questions like that, to, you know, how do birds fly, and whatever, you know, questions about nature, or whatever your questions are. So, you know, will we survive global warming?
Yeah.
You know, so, and so then you can look at it and say, well, is my body of work developing around these key questions? And you think, well, obviously they must be, but sometimes we can kind of get, especially writers who get assignments from other people a lot, and there's a way that you can certainly direct your own work, even if you're getting assignments from other people. In fact, we do that. But so that's one way to use questions. But every story has questions. So that's mm-hmm. one. So another is to draw threads from your subject matter to similar subject matters in history or in mythology. So, for example, Diane Ackerman in her piece, Mute Dancers, which is about hummingbirds, goes to the use of hummingbirds and the meaning of hummingbirds to the Aztecs. That's one of her 9 paragraphs.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
For example, there's a wonderful essay by Francine Duplessis Gray on the death of her father. And this brings us back to structure too, because there are these five stages of grief, of accepting death, I think, that Elizabeth Kubler-Ross and you know spoke about.
Yeah.
And so so her essay on her father, and the first is denial. Okay. So her essay on her father has five parts.
Oh,
guess what?
Great, yeah. Absolutely.
And the first one, denial. We don't know that her father died when she was 10 in the French Resistance until part two. First part, denial. She's talking about her father's death, but she, it's an absolutely monumental essay. And she goes to Freud on death wish. She goes to all the literature. I mean, you can do this larger or smaller. I mean, she does it large here.
Right.
So you can go to outside, let's call them mirrors.
Yes.
We have mirrors of, and nothing is, there's mirrors to everything. So an episode in history. So part of it is to, if you're, especially if you're writing memoir or a personal essay, is to draw threads to the outside world, to mirrors in that world. And one way is to collect epigraphs, which are those little quotes that often will start an essay or a piece. And an epigraph is a mirror. That's a mirror right there. And the quote from someone else, whether it's a philosopher or it's from a poem or whatever it's from, it is, it sort of holds what this is about.
Yeah.
And so collecting epigraphs is another way. And I'm sure there are other ways, but there are these ways. Oh, the final thing I definitely want to say about this is a way to increase the insight you can bring to any piece or any short story or any novel you're writing is to simply do a write which starts with the question, how can I bring 5% more insight to this piece, and then write? And it's actually quite remarkable what you can come up with.
That's amazing. Well, I want to mention, we don't have time to talk about it, but I want to mention that I really enjoyed the part of the book that deals with sending out your work, trying to get published. I loved the way that you tried to accumulate rejections rather than get published when you were first sending stuff out. I thought that was great.
Yes.
I really enjoyed that about the book.
Great. Thank you.
And I just have, I have one last question for you. As a student of writing and a writer and a teacher, I'm wondering if you can speak to the ways in which writers impede our own progress.
How a writer how you hold yourself up with your progress as a writer, is that what you're saying?
Yeah. I think sometimes we get in our own way, and I wonder, from your experiences,
sure.
What are
I
those
think
ways?
The one reason I am a great advocate of writing every day, even if it's 10 minutes, I mean, it's writing every day. It's not, I have to be more disciplined. I have to, is because it helps you to drop this idea that, is this going to be good, or isn't it going to be good, or is it going to be good, or isn't it going to be good? If it's no good, you know, that's very self-destructive, and it's destructive to the creative work. And it's a very interesting fact that the virtuoso creators, there are all these studies of high-level creators, which I've, have studied the studies, for years and years. And so it's a very interesting fact that the highest level creators in all fields, visual arts, writing, all that, not only do they create more masterworks than more average creators, they also create more duds. That's very interesting. And so this business of hesitating before doing the work and the episodic work habit is something to just ditch. I think it's very useful to realize that you can write for 15 minutes or 20 minutes a day, and that will make you a writer. But if you don't, many writers just don't believe that, but the writers who know it believe it. Productive writers know it, because it can keep you, because that doesn't mean you write only for 15 minutes a day, but that means on a day where you have a tremendous amount to do, you're in a bad mood, on and on, whatever. You have your job, you have your children, you have this and that and the other. You can still find 15 minutes on that day. And that, if you do that, no one could write great writing every day. I mean, that would be insane. That would be foolish to think
right.
that. And
right.
so that really helps you to just drop that whole business of, is this going to be good? Also, the more you work on your craft and you can see, and specifically take time each week or whatever your time frame is, to work on a craft skill, the more you see that anything you write that's really from the heart and you really wanted to write it can be made into a brilliant piece if you have the craft skills.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, you can go back, years and take something that, you know, was sort of not very good. Well, there are two things about this. One is that you can think something is not very good and keep it and look back on it and you realize, oh, actually, that is pretty good. Because our subjective feeling about it is often incorrect.
Right.
So I think that, you know, everyone talks about the critic, the inner critic, and it's quite true. And it's partly a discipline. Just get rid of it.
Yeah.
And also to not engage in being, if you feel you're being neurotic, in other words, oh, this is awful, I just can't even stand looking at it for another minute, just put it aside.
Yeah.
Because you're not going to constructively revise it. But the more you get skilled at craft, the better you are at making a beautiful piece.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's great. That's wonderful advice. Thank you so much for speaking with me today. I thought this was really useful and fun.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
That, again, was a conversation with Priscilla Long. You can learn more about her work at her website, priscillalong.com. Just one item for the Bookworm's calendar this week, and it relates to my show next week. Wendy Call, the 2011 writer in residence at the Marsh Billings Rockefeller National Historical Park in Woodstock, is going to be offering writing workshops as part of her work down there. The title of the workshops is Change in the Places We Love. She's offering that on Friday, September 9th from 5 to 7, and on Saturday, September 17th, from noon to 2 in the Carriage Barn Visitor Center. She's also going to be offering a special workshop, for teachers on Monday, September 12th from 8 to noon in the Forest Center. And Wendy is going to be my guest next week on Write the Book. Her book is called No Word for Welcome. For this week's Write the Book prompt, I will offer two exercises in writing voice from Priscilla Long's book on craft, The Writer's Portable Mentor, to practice capturing voices that you know well. Spend 15 minutes writing a bitter complaint in your own most colloquial voice. And a second exercise from that same section of the book is to spend 5 minutes writing beyond this opening statement. My father always used to say, dot, dot, dot. Good luck with this exercise. Please listen next week for another. I will, as always, I will be reproducing those exercises, the writing prompt, on the podcast site. So if you didn't get a chance to write it down quickly, you can have a look at the podcast site to see the prompts. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know. They can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are also available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. That's where you can find those writing prompts also written out. If you have comments about the show, news about book-related events, or a writing prompt that you'd like to send me to possibly be included in the show, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. WOMMLP, The Radiator, is an all-volunteer organization. The station operates in Burlington thanks to community support and involvement. You can find out more by checking out theradiator.org, our website. Stay tuned. I'm going to put some music on now from the Vermont Music Library. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. I know it's raining, but enjoy your Labor Day, what's left of it.